Access number 4653.
This is Grindley, Reel 5. Mrs. Grindley, you mentioned last time we were talking that there was a special relationship between the Japanese guards and the Hong Kong police.
Special relationship?
In the sense that they acted as go-betweens in some way for some purposes.
Oh, yes. That was for the... Not necessarily the police. Some of them did, for getting stuff into the camp. Selling gold and things like that, and getting food in. But, not really that... Not. I wouldn't call it a special relationship. Because, I mean, there was the other fellow from the jail. He was one of the go-betweens. So it wasn't entirely all the police.
One of the problems, I imagine, for internees was that you were living in really quite close quarters,
yes,
fairly crowded
yes,
situation.
Yes.
And I wonder whether that created any problems, any stresses, tensions.
Well, I think it did amongst the people, say, five and six to a room. There was always squabbles about who should clean the room and minor, not really bad things, but minor things, squabbles really, not... Nothing more than that. And somebody would say, well, you've got more rice than I have, and the measure was more full when you got it.
Mm.
And all petty things, really, that you can imagine would arise out of a situation like that.
And what about relationships between people who were relatively well off, who had a fair amount of money, and those who were not so well off? Did that create any...
Well, they all seemed to come down to the same level, because... Well, they just couldn't do anything else about it. Everybody had the same rations, the same accommodation, and that was all there was to it.
Unless you had some private funds when you could buy more rations.
Yeah, but they didn't have private funds because they only came into the camp with what they had. And they couldn't acquire any more money than the goods that they had to sell. There was
if they had a lot of money in the Hong Kong bank, for example.
They could get it out then. Mm. I don't doubt they did, yes. But then that came to an end. That didn't go on forever. It didn't go on for very long. Mm.
Was there much variation between the standards enjoyed by summer internees and those...
Yes, I think you're right there, because the people that had the money, they would... buy up other people's canteen tickets if they didn't have the money to spend, and they would get extra rations that way.
Mm.
But that was the only way they could do it.
Would that kind of thing just be accepted, or did it ever cause an ill feeling?
No, I think it was just accepted. If you were lucky enough to get more than the next man, well, that was your good luck.
Mm-hmm. Were there any problems of the... mixing of the various national groups who were within the internment camp? Did some groups not get on with the others, or...?
Oh, yes, yes, that was... The only thing is the Dutch and the Norwegians always kept to themselves. But that was as far as it went. There was no bad feeling or anything. The only niggly thing was with the Americans. And when they went, that was it finished, and things were quite good.
Yes. We've talked already to some extent about the work that you did. You've explained the cooking routines.
Yes, yeah.
What other kinds of routine work did the internees have to do in the camp?
Well, they didn't have to do anything, but the girls that were employed in government, they reported every day at 9 o'clock. And they did a certain amount of typing and filing, general office work. But the majority of people, they didn't have to do anything, but if they wanted to be comfortable, they had to keep their place clean, and that was as far as it went.
Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that they didn't have to, was there work available which people chose to do?
Making shoes and things like that, yes, yes, they did. They did choose to do that, but that was only for what they could get.
The Japanese, did they ever require the internees to do any work of any kind?
The only thing they ever required them to do was to go and get the rations. They had to get those. And the time when this junk loads of wood came in, they made all the camp people cart all the wood into the various blocks. But apart from that, there was no forced labour as such. They didn't have to sweep roads or anything like that. What they did was for their own community. With that one except, well, that was the community really, but they wouldn't let Chinese come into the camp and do the carrying.
What kinds of things would the internees do for their own community, as you put it?
Work-wise? Cooking and keeping the place clean and... is that what you mean?
Well, I mean anything at all by way of work, of special jobs, unusual jobs that you can recall?
There's no special job, no. It was just ordinary routine, everyday cooking and what have you. It was really boring, really.
It sounds as if you were an awful lot of the time the internees, in fact, weren't doing anything.
They weren't doing anything. That's it. Just aimlessly wandering around.
Filling time.
Filling time.
Ways.
Can you imagine a whole group of people stuck on a small peninsula with little food? What would they do but just mill around? They just walked around in groups.
My only experience of that was when I was in the Air Force on a small station in Cyprus, and we seemed to spend more time involved in playing football, cricket, sporting activities than any other. Were these very much in evidence at Stanley?
In the beginning, yes, they did. They played baseball and football, but then as time went on and the food got less, they just hadn't the inclination to do these vigorous sports.
Right. News from... you've explained how you had the map at St. Stephen's and kept some check on what was going on in the war. That was through the Chinese newspapers. Were there any other sources from which news of what was going on?
No, the only source of news came through the ration lorry and the radio. We used to get a little news from that until, of course, they took that away. So that was finished. That must have been about 12 months, I suppose, before the end of the war. So, really, it didn't make all that much difference. The only things we found were happening was in the attitude of the Japanese. If things had gone wrong for them, then they would shout and kick and slap faces. If things were going right for them, that all stopped. So you could usually tell from the mood of the Japanese how the things were going for them.
This radio you mentioned for the first 12 months, were you allowed to keep that radio, or was this a secret radio?
No, it was a secret radio. It was only one. Waterhouse, I think his name was. He was in a government department anyway. But they took he... and Mr. Fraser, who was my boss in the Supreme Court, Freddie Hall, who was in the canteen, plus the Chinese on the ration lorry, and that was where all the information was coming from. And they took them down, they came through the camp one day in a van, and they all shouted, "Goodbye, goodbye," and they took them down on the beach, and that was the end. Now, that was the fellow that had the radio. Mr. Fraser was the one that was getting the stuff typed to go to Macau, and I think the Chinese were the one that was taking it out on the lorry. Freddie Hall was in the canteen. Now, he was involved some way in getting the information out.
And they were all shot?
Executed.
Were you called upon to witness
them? No, we weren't. They kept that very quiet.
Yes. As far as you know, were there any other radios started up after that incident?
No, I don't think so, no. Well, they wouldn't have been able to get the parts or couldn't have smuggled it in.
Okay.
No way.
During this period of internment, did you get any news from home?
Not one word. And my mother had no news of me at all. She tried through the Red Cross, but as far as she could, they thought that I was alive, and that's all she knew. But I say we wrote these postcards, oh, umpteen postcards we wrote, but they were never delivered.
Oh, after this period of what? Four years
Four
in the
years,
term of, yes.
45.
Can you remember any particular time or event from which you began to feel that the end of the war was in sight and liberation?
Oh, yes. The day we got up in the morning and there were no guards. There was nobody in the camp. And we just couldn't make out what had happened, where they'd gone. The night before, we had heard them, a crowd of Japanese marching away, singing. And didn't mean anything to us. But then it came through that they had dropped the bombs on, was it?
Hiroshima.
Hiroshima, that's right. And then we thought, well, what happens now? But they just left, just walked out and left the camp with nobody in it, no Japanese anywhere.
What happened after that?
Well, of course, we had to stop people going into Hong Kong, because that was the first thing everybody wanted to do. They wanted to go into Hong Kong. Of course, there wasn't any transport anyway, but it's a bit hazy, that little period. I just can't quite remember what happens. But I know I did get into Hong Kong and had a look around. And, well, to me it was just the same as it had been before. There was no apparent damage or anything. But then after that, then they started to, I think it was Admiral Harcourt came in with the Navy. Of course, then they started bringing in the food, then they brought in the Red Cross parcels, which we should have had. And then we began to wonder, well, are we going to get out of this? And there again, you had to put your names down. And eventually, it all came to an end. But
Sorry, who was after rifles? I didn't quite...
The sailors, our British sailors, were after swords and, well, souvenirs, anything like that. And I know this young fellow got this automatic rifle, and he should have known better. He turned it round on himself and shot himself in the stomach, right in the middle of the road.
In the period before the Japanese abandoned Stanley, was there no evidence that you know, the war was about to end? That I mean, it sounds all terribly abrupt. Had you had no
indication? No, not really, because
previously?
They didn't ever tell you anything. Naturally, they wouldn't tell you anything. We began to wonder what was happening, because we used to see the bombers go over. The crap, you know, about hundreds of them were going over. And then one day we were all down in the clubhouse and we saw these. We thought they were something out of space. They were B-29s. We'd never seen anything. A double fuselage? Mm. We'd never seen anything like that. Well, they machine gunned us. Americans, of course. Machine gunned us, and we thought, well, what's going on now? But they thought, again, that we were the fort and that they were machine gunning the Japanese. And they machine gunned the camp. They shelled the camp, bombed the camp, and destroyed a bungalow and killed all the people in it.
So the Americans made the same mistake.
They made the same mistake, yeah. Mm. Yes.
So
that was the first indication that things might be coming to an end, was when we saw these, because we used to, there used to be a plane go round every night, and we knew by the sound of it that that was a Japanese. But these had a different sound. Mm. And they went over in their hundreds. And we began to feel then that, well, things might be coming to an end.
Mm. How did life carry on the in Stanley Camp after the Japanese left?
Well, the food, I think, I can't remember really what happened, but the people from the village, from Stanley Village itself, started coming into the camp. And I can always remember swapping a blanket for half a dozen duck eggs to a Chinese woman. Because they had no money. If we had any yen, that was no use. Mm-hmm. So it was barter system again.
When the British reoccupied Hong Kong, what arrangements were made for you and other internees?
We were sent away from the camp, you see. We went on an aircraft carrier to Colombo. And from there we went on a P&O boat home.
Did your evacuation of Hong Kong come shortly after the reoccupation of Hong Kong?
Yes. I think it was August the 15th, I think, was the day when Admiral Harcourt addressed us all and told us that we were now free. But of course, I think it must have been 3 weeks to a month after that before the arrangements could be made, because they put them in, all the sick went first. And then the people that were going to come back and reoccupy Hong Kong, they went next. And then the rest went after that. So we were in the second batch, actually, because my husband was judged fit enough that he could stay for a while and help get the jail running, go on leave, short leave, 6 months, and then come back again to really start the jail going again.
And that's what's happened.
That's what happened, yes. Mm. He came back, and then I followed later on.
Mm. Did the period of internment have any long-term effects in any way?
I don't really think it did. I don't really know. I know somebody told me once that, don't you worry, the camp will catch up with you sometime, but it hasn't caught up with me yet, I don't think. I don't think it did, really.